The clock is counting down. For months, really probably the better part of a year or more, Mel Gibson's life ambition, his life's work, his opus magnum, the movie called The Passion of Christ, has been in the news for various reasons. Among them, and probably most notably in terms of its newsworthiness, is accusations that the film has a dark depiction of the Jews in their complicity to crucify Christ. Now, Gibson has been very hesitant to respond personally to this, and given the fact that this was a closed set and very few people have actually been seeing the movie, although more and more as we get closer to its actual release on Ash Wednesday, the question still does persist, and many people are suspending judgment until they actually see the Passion film. I'm going to be seeing it almost as soon as it opens. I'm curious about this. I'm also curious about a number of other things. We're going to be talking about an interview that you may have seen in the latest edition of Newsweek magazine with the lead actor, James Caviezel, for Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of Christ. That's the first 25 minutes or so of Issues Etc. today. In the second 25 minutes of this hour, Georgette Forney, co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign, joins us to talk about the after effects of abortion. There in the second hour, Uwe Simonetto, our good friend from United Press International, where he serves as religion editor, will join us for a religion roundup. We'll be talking about the stereotype that evangelicals live with. Also, the Hajj, 244 plus people who were trampled several weeks ago. And then we'll also be talking about why it is that so many are returning to Rome. Why is Roman Catholicism still growing by millions every year? And people don't seem to notice it. That, among other things, with Uwe Simonetto. And then, let's see, a little later in the program, near the end of the program, we'll be talking with Josh Baker, policy analyst for the Institute for Marriage and Public Policy based in Washington, D.C., about two issues: the federal marriage amendment, which the president today has said through a spokesman he will endorse, and President Bush's marriage initiative. That's the lineup for Issues Etc. There in the middle, a little open lines from 4:30 to 5:30 for your questions and your comments. I want to talk about ecclesiastical Darwinism. I'm not going to tell you what I'm talking about. Maybe the brighter of you will be able to put the numbers together and connect the dots. But I'll be talking about that during open lines from 4:30 to 5:30 here on Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Sean Smith is a senior writer for Newsweek magazine. He recently interviewed James Caviezel. He is the lead actor in The Passion of Christ for the latest issue of Newsweek. Sean, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you.
First of all, the biggest question that probably on everyone's mind is, how did the lead actor there respond to the rumors that have been circulating regarding the anti-Semitism of this forthcoming movie by Gibson?
He made a really eloquent defense of that. He talked a lot about how, you know, working with Mel on this movie, that he didn't see any evidence of anti-Semitism from Mel personally during the making of the film. In fact, there's a Romanian Jewish actress playing the Virgin Mary who apparently Mel, you know, asked a lot of questions about her heritage and was sort of making sure that he was being faithful to her faith and the history of her people. So, you know, he really sort of made a very eloquent defense of it and talked a lot about how that the film doesn't accuse all Jews of killing Jesus any more than, say, Stalin is somehow, all the Russian people should be punished for Stalin, or all of the Italians should be punished for Mussolini.
Did he give any indication of why, at least for quite some time, Gibson himself was hesitant to respond to the criticisms swirling around this movie?
He did not talk about that, but Gibson himself had sort of said multiple times that the film speaks for itself, and that sort of I would assume that just even talking about it only contributes to the, from his perspective, he thought that just talking about it would only increase the attention paid to it.
Playing Jesus is not, it was not the first person to play Jesus, of course, but it's been done so badly in previous so-called Jesus films, and this one promises to be really an amazing film in a number of ways. It's still a daunting role. What was Caviezel's reaction to being asked to play what Christians consider to be the savior of the world?
It was an incredibly daunting task. He had met with Mel's company, Icon, under the guise, they had told him they wanted to talk to him about making a surfing movie. And about midway through the meeting, Mel showed up and started talking about Jesus, and it sort of hit Caviezel at that time, oh no, you want me to play Jesus? He told me, which is not in the story, that his initial thought was, oh, I really just kind of want to go play a comedy, you know? It's always daunting, I think, to sort of play someone who is that important to so many people around the world. But I also think that in this case, it was one of the most physically daunting tasks, because this film is the last 12 hours of Christ's life, and it is incredibly brutal, and he went through amazing sort of physical torment to even get it made, including getting struck by lightning and dislocating his shoulder and suffering from hypothermia, and, you know, it wasn't exactly what you'd call fun.
I've seen the trailer of the movie. I know they can do an awful lot with makeup, but I sense, especially in the scenes where Christ is at the cross, I sense that this wasn't Caviezel simply standing on a platform and playing it easy.
Oh, not at all. In fact, the crucifixion scene, you actually see the spikes going into his hands and his feet, and they sort of pound them in real time. It's very, very bloody, and it does not flinch from that, and it doesn't allow the viewer to flinch from it either. You look at it, and it's almost excruciating to watch, frankly, just for that long of a period of time, because you're watching a man, whether you believe he's the savior or not, you're watching someone being beaten up and brutalized for hours, and it's hard to watch.
Caviezel is a Catholic himself. What did he say about the role of playing this role in his own personal faith?
He said that it really deepened his faith deeply, that he connected. What he said literally was that he loves Jesus more now than his wife and his family, that he connected to a deeper place that he'd never would have been able to go otherwise. And when he speaks about the role, I mean, he has a sense of humor about it, you know, sort of the difficulties of making it, but he's a devout man, and you can tell that this had this deepened his faith in a lot of ways and made him think about, when people say, you know, Jesus died for your sins, this movie really shows it, you know, and I think playing it sort of reminded him of the sacrifice that was made.
Gibson has said several times in the press that this has been a movie he has wanted to make for decades. What's the story behind that?
He had years ago, I guess it was about 12 years ago or so, he had sort of gone through a difficult period in his life and had sort of rediscovered the Gospels. And this is apparently the time when Gibson sort of renewed his faith. And it was at that point that I think he really started thinking about, you know, sort of making a movie like this. But he's been, you know, he's been a Catholic for, to my knowledge, most of his life. And I assume that, you know, when you get to a certain position that Mel has and you have the power to do it, this is not an easy movie to get made. And when you're in a position of power where you can do it without having to go ask a studio for the money, you know, he was able to do it finally.
How are the first century Jewish leaders depicted in this film?
It's very interesting. They the way that the film is presented is that there's not a lot of exposition, in the sense that he does not tell you, okay, these are the Jewish leaders and these are... He doesn't signify who these people are. In fact, you're supposed to sort of assume... He assumes that we know who these people are. And so a lot of these Jewish leaders are all sort of nameless. They don't... no one ever calls them by their name or whatever. They are shown as calling for the crucifixion of and the death of Christ. It is, however, the Romans who inflict the scourging on him, which is really the film's most brutal scene other than the crucifixion, and are the ones who actually nail him to the cross. So it's a mixed bag that way, I guess, in terms of who is accepting the blame, or who is being depicted as having the blame.
I understand that the film was originally intended, at least early in the production, to be filmed entirely in the languages of first century Palestine, primarily Aramaic, but maybe Latin and Greek, perhaps in there, without subtitles. Has that plan stayed afloat?
No, the film does have subtitles now. Although, when you see it, you can see why Gibson wanted to do that. It sounds ridiculous when you first hear that, meaning why would anyone go see a movie that with a language that no one speaks and no one could understand? But there's very little dialogue in this film, very little. And so you actually could have gotten away with it, I think, and had it still make sense, because the story is so well known. I'm sure his motivation was to sort of put you there as if you were actually, you know, there at the time. But yeah, there are subtitles now. But even so, there's very little language, really.
Where was this filmed? I understand that for many of the scenes, the outdoor scenes, they were in some pretty inclement weather.
Yeah, they were in Italy, and the movie looks like it's shot in the heat of summer. It looks incredibly hot. But apparently it was winter and incredibly cold, which just goes to speak to the magic of movie making, I guess. But yeah, so Caviezel was, you know, up there on the cross and, you know, winds coming down the canyons, and they had storms, which is, you know, how I got struck by lightning and all that. So yeah, it's apparently it was very, very cold.
How does an actor pull off, okay, you are practically naked, you are simulating in a very realistic way a real crucifixion. You've been under dire circumstances in filming this film already. You're out in the cold in the winter in Italy, and you're expected to deliver your lines in Aramaic.
It's pretty amazing, and it's an amazing achievement, I think, on James Caviezel's part to be able to pull it off. I will say that I think the physical pain that he was personally undergoing really helped look like he's in pain on film, but he is, you know, his character is an excruciating pain the entire film, and it looks amazing. It looks as if he's really tortured, and I suppose that if you're up on a cross in a loincloth and, you know, 10-degree wind is whipping around your body, that it's pretty easy to look like you're in pain.
The film will carry an R rating?
Yes, for sure.
For the violence and the simulated gore and things like this.
The violence. In fact, after I saw it, I thought it might even get an NC-17. It's that violent. But yes, it's an R.
Is it, in your estimation, just as an observer of the film, is it over the top with regard to its depiction of violence?
No, I just think I don't think it's over the top. It's just that most movie violence, you know, you get a shot of something, you know, like let's say someone's being shot in a movie and you see just a flash of it, and then you cut away to someone's reaction or whatever. In this, he just holds on these moments. He does not cut away from any of the pain that's being inflicted on Jesus in all of its different forms. So it feels so much more violent only because you get so few breaks, really, to go away to something else. And you also just don't cut away from these moments. He shoots them, and it is really... you know, it's hard to watch. You look away, even if the film doesn't.
The actual event ends with a resurrection. Does Gibson's film end with a resurrection a la the gospel accounts?
Yes, it's very subtly done, actually. It's all shot from within, you know, the tomb where Jesus is. And all you see is you hear a stone moving across the top, and you see light sort of channeling through. And then it's just Jesus in profile, and he stands up and walks out of the screen into the light. It's very short. I think it's probably the shortest scene in the movie.
Really?
Over the sound of drums. It's kind of cool, actually.
Is it is it the final scene of the movie? Is that
it
how
is.
The movie ends?
Yes.
I hate to ask this because this movie, at least for me as a Christian, I expect it to be a very profound experience going to see this movie as it sounds like it's going to be, but how do you think it's going to do?
I think it's going to do incredibly well, actually. It's certainly the kind of film that so many people are going to want to go see, even if they aren't Christians themselves, only because there's so much attention paid to it that I think people are going to want to see what all the fuss is about. But it's also an incredibly well-made film. It's aside from if you take all the religious aspects and the controversy about anti-Semitism and all that away from it, it's really an incredibly well-made, powerful film. And on a human level, so much of this movie is actually about the relationship between Jesus and Mary, in some ways even more so than about Jesus and God. You know, and that is really interesting. And on a human level, the idea of a mother watching this happen to her son is something that everyone can relate to, even if you don't believe that Jesus is the Son of God.
Do you think that the airing of the final release of the film, and with the chance for everyone to go see it who wants to see it, do you think it will lay to rest the criticisms that have been leveled at it even before it's released?
I think this film will continue to sort of sort of inspire discussion. I think what will happen is once the film is out, that type of discussion will change. Instead of speculation about whether it's anti-Semitic and what the damage could be, I think once people get to see it, you have a nation having an informed discussion, really, of what it says and what it means, as opposed to speculating about what it might say or might mean. So I think in some ways it will quiet it, but I think it will also elevate the discussion to more of an academic historical discussion rather than, does Mel Gibson hate Jews or something?
Finally, to your knowledge, is Mel Gibson planning with the release of this movie of doing, he's done a lot of screenings by invitation, is he planning on doing press the way most filmmakers, directors, producers do with the release of a film?
Yes, I believe he will. I mean, I think he's going to be on Diane Sawyer here next week. So yes, he's going to, and I'm sure you'll probably see him do quite a few interviews, although they're not doing... most movies have a thing called a junket, which is where they bring out the whole cast and, a bunch of press people show up from around the country and, they all get 15 minutes with each of those people. They're not doing one of those for this film. So I think he's just doing selected press as opposed to being, everywhere at once.
Yeah, I also seriously doubt there'll be a red carpet kind of a gala premiere for this thing if Gibson has anything to say about it.
Right. I mean, I even if they do have a premiere, I can't imagine it's going to be the usual glitzy flashbulb kind of thing, no.
Sean Smith, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Thanks for being our guest.
You bet.
Sean Smith is a senior writer for Newsweek magazine. He recently interviewed James Caviezel, who plays Christ, in Mel Gibson's upcoming movie, The Passion of Christ. You can read the transcript for this interview, by the way, on the web at Newsweek's website, newsweek.com. That's newsweek.com. For the remainder of this hour, we're going to be talking with Georgette Forney. She is co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign about the after effects of abortion. I've heard again and again and again of this Silent No More and the after effects, that there are women who survive abortions, every single one of them, and that these women deal with real consequences from their abortion. What are those consequences? We'll be talking about that for the remainder of this hour. Georgette Forney is our guest. Georgette, welcome to Issues Etc.
Great to be with you, Todd.
Tell us a little bit about Silent No More in terms of what it's trying to do for information for women surviving abortion.
Well, it's a campaign. Just like years ago there was an AIDS awareness campaign or a breast cancer awareness campaign, we have put together a campaign to raise awareness about what abortion does to millions of women. Now, we are not claiming that every woman who has an abortion regrets her decision. And I want to make that clear, that some women will clearly say that this is something they were grateful they did. But we find that more women than not do regret it and live in kind of this sense in which nobody's talking about it, so I must be the only one who regrets it, and they suffer in silence. Which is why we named it Silent No More. We are going to be silent no more about what we've suffered with and what we've, the shame we've felt, the guilt that we've felt, the incredible sadness for our loss.
Obviously, this, of course, will be a case-by-case kind of an event with women, but can you give us a typical profile of what a woman will go through, both short-term and long-term, after an abortion?
I can give you two typicals, because that's how we've kind of break them down. The one typical woman has an abortion and probably wasn't really keen on it to begin with and wanted the baby, but the father or other people in her life felt and encouraged her to, and said things like, now is not the best time. You can have a baby when you're ready. So she went ahead and had the abortion, and immediately before she was finished with the procedure, began to regret it and began to carry the burden of it. I call that kind of an acute response. Immediately she knew that she did something wrong and she regretted it, and she began to wish that she could change the outcome. There are a lot of other women who fall into what I call my category, which is we live in denial for a number of years. For myself, I had my abortion when I was 16 years old, and I remember thinking after I got off the table and as I was driving away, that just never happened. That was too much to even process, so I'm just going to pretend that didn't happen. And that's called denial. And it's an emotion that we have. It's a skill we have when something is too traumatic. Now, I didn't understand any of that as a 16-year-old, but the reality is for events that are too traumatic for us to process, we deny their reality. And a lot of women will walk in that denial. I walked in that denial for 19 years. Every now and then I would think about my abortion. Every now and then, when I heard the word abortion, I would get that little twist in my stomach, like somebody twisting a knife. And that would help me to know, oh my gosh, that's right, I did that. But I managed and I worked very hard to deny it. And I lived that way for 19 years. And it wasn't until just one of those bizarre experiences that God burst through my own awareness. And I recognized in just a freak accident kind of thing, the loss of my baby. And I started crying because I realized what I had lost in that abortion. But I had, for 19 years, managed to deny the reality of that baby because I couldn't face that baby.
So it wasn't just a denial of the procedure. It was a denial of the life that was taken.
Right. It was a denial of the whole event. I mean, the pregnancy didn't happen. Nothing happened. I mean, I just pretended it was never there. But nonetheless, you can't erase those kind of traumatic events. And when it burst forth, I fortunately had a friend who had told me about her own abortion experience. So I called her and I said, help! And I was crying and I was overwhelmed. And she came and she began praying with me and talking to me and telling me about the forgiveness of Christ and that this too was a forgivable sin and that even though I made the choice to kill my baby, which is what I had done, that I was allowed to grieve for my baby. And I thought that was just so strange to hear because I thought, well, I made the choice. How can I now go back and say I regret that? That almost seemed hypocritical. But I realized that there are things in all of our lives, sins that we've all committed that we really at the time didn't completely understand or were overwhelmed, and we've all sinned. And as I began to really understand that God could forgive every sin, including abortion, and that as I turned to him and I asked for that forgiveness, he really could forgive me. I could forgive myself. I could know my baby was in heaven, and I could grieve that loss and honestly mourn.
Georgette Forney is our guest. We're going to take a break here, and when we come back, we'll continue talking about the after effects of abortion. She's co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. I wonder about this, folks. We've talked about it before with several guests. The denial sometimes find itself kind of in a perverse way coming out in terms of advocacy for abortion. It's amazing how many pro-abortion activists have had abortions. We'll talk about that when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172. Or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Now this Global Minute focuses prayer on finding Christians who will serve with passion and purpose by teaching overseas. In Eastern Europe, high school and college students are eager to have Americans teach them conversational English. Sharing your knowledge of these subjects allows you to let your care for others shine while making lifelong friends. The Christian agency TeachOverseas.org provides all the training, so you don't even need a teaching degree. School officials in countries like Hungary and the Czech Republic are eager to find dedicated teachers who will instruct the students professionally, yet take a personal interest in them. Christians are urgently needed to fill the many teaching positions that are available. Pray that people who love Christ will respond and serve with purpose and passion by teaching overseas in Eastern Europe or other regions. Get more information by visiting the website teachoverseas.org. That's teachoverseas.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Today, the House and Senate of Massachusetts are meeting to consider a state constitutional amendment to define marriage as between a man and a woman. While Bible passages don't dictate legislation, the attitudes and actions of true Christians, legislators included, are shaped by what the Bible teaches. In an article in the Concordia Commentary on 1 Corinthians, Dr. Gregory Lockwood writes, "From beginning to end, the Bible condemns the practice of homosexuality as an unnatural perversion." After a careful look at many passages, Lockwood admits, "All of this seems intolerably harsh to our modern culture. Nonetheless, we need to take the divine word at face value." Sensitive pastoral care, he writes, will involve assuring the homosexual person that the pastor is speaking to him or her out of love and acceptance, but not approval, avoiding anything that smacks of Pharisaic condemnations, keeping lines of communications open for law gospel ministry, opening opportunities for confession and absolution. In all the current discussion about gay marriage, a true Christian keeps the Bible in mind. What does it say about your faith if you don't?
Communication.
After 10 years of married life, I found out that sex was not the most important thing to my wife, Sandy.
Is it a vital part of your relationship with your spouse?
What could be more important than sex in a marriage? I couldn't think of one thing.
On the next Focus on the Family, Dr. Kevin Lehman takes a humorous and eye-opening look at the way men and women communicate. Don't miss it.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. Georgette Forney is our guest. We're talking about the after effects of abortion. She's co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. You may have heard about it. I heard about it. We got curious and looked them up. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Georgette, before the break, you were talking about your own denial, 19 years of denial after your abortion at the age of age 16. Do you think that sometimes that denial manifests itself among the advocates of abortion as kind of a more fervent advocacy for this thing?
Oh, sure. Absolutely. And I think I have to confess and be honest with you that in the early 90s, if somebody would have said to me, Georgette, what's your position? I would have said this. I am publicly pro-choice. But personally, I would not want a woman to have an abortion. And I would say that to cover myself because I knew I had an abortion. And so I thought, oh, my gosh, I can't say to somebody else, you can't have that right because I did that. And so that was my kind of response, was that I would say that I was kind of pro-choice because, you know, everybody's got to be able to choose. And so it's a sense in which you don't feel you can judge somebody else. I now hearken that to kind of an analogy with a heroin addict and saying, you know, well, you know, I could never tell, if I were a heroin addict, I couldn't tell somebody else not to do heroin because that's their right to do heroin. But as somebody who's a heroin addict and understands the devastation that heroin does to a person's life and that, you know, damage, I would be foolish to deny somebody else my knowledge. And so I realized that it was the same thing for abortion, that there were lots of women out there hurting, and that it would be foolish for us to stay silent thinking that we had no right to tell somebody else what to do. We are trying to protect our sisters from making the same mistake we did.
Well, for what it's worth, and I'm sure you've heard this many, many times before, otherwise you wouldn't be doing what you're doing, I think some of the most compelling arguments that have been laid forth in the public square against abortion have been made by women who, regretfully, have had abortions themselves.
Well, and unfortunately, we are the voice that hasn't been heard as often as it should be. You know, it's easy to take political positions, but the person caught in the middle is the woman. And oftentimes we forget, and it's so important that in the pro-life community, we all focus on the humanity of the baby and the right to life in and of itself. And those are very valiant and honest efforts that have gone on for 30 years. But I've really come to the conclusion that for me personally, and I can't say to another woman, don't have an abortion, without also standing up and saying, what can I do to help you so you can choose life? You know, the reality is women, that I've come to understand, is women don't choose abortions because we think they're great nifty procedures like getting our tonsils out or, you know, having a tooth pulled. We have abortions because we feel we have no other choice. We feel that we don't have the emotional support system. We don't have the love and support of the father of the child, of the parents around us, of those who have the opportunity to positively influence us. They also have the opportunity to negatively influence us. So if I don't hear any positive affirmation to say, you can be a great mother, I'm not getting that support. And then if I'm thinking I'm a teenage girl or I'm a young college student, and I know that the health care plan for my college doesn't cover pregnancy and hospitalization for, you know, delivery, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? Do I know that the welfare system is out there and what it offers? No. I think we have to get much smarter about saying to women, what are your needs? Why are you thinking abortion is your only solution? And how can we come alongside you and really support you? You do have choices, lots of them.
You mentioned the position that you had held in the 90s during that period of denial where you would have said, you know, I'm publicly pro-choice, but privately I just would never encourage anyone to do this.
Mm-hmm.
There's another kind of a default position that a lot of people who call themselves pro-life occupy, which is, well, I'm personally opposed to abortion. And it's kind of the inverse of what you just said. Mm-hmm. I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I can't see legislating against it. That just, you know, although I think it's wrong, I think it's murder, I just can't see legislating against it.
Well, and if you think about it, what they're subtly saying is that culturally we're dependent upon abortion to handle 1.3 million unplanned pregnancies a year. And if we really start saying to women, don't have abortions, are we really prepared to what that's going to mean to every individual, especially pro-lifers? It means that as a pro-lifer, we're going to have to really step up our support for pregnancy resource centers, for mothers' homes, for mentoring a young couple that finds themselves facing an unplanned pregnancy and unwed. I mean, we really have to rethink culturally where we're going to go as we seek to make abortion unthinkable. Because right now, our culture depends upon abortion to handle 1.3 million babies and women.
That's a grisly reality, but I'm compelled to agree with you there.
Well, unfortunately, that is a reality. I mean, we are not at... And you need to understand, I am such a proponent of making abortion illegal. But we can't just simply say to women, don't have abortions. Because you know what? They will go back and have illegal abortions. And that will still hurt women, and we'll still have babies die. I do not want to settle for making it illegal. I want to make it unthinkable so that no woman feels that she has to kill her own in order to survive.
Let's talk about some of the real effects. I've talked with other guests who have pointed out, and if I'm remembering correctly, they kind of fall into several categories. The research on what happens to women after abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Clinical depression is a very high incidence. They seek psychological help. Alcohol and drug abuse seems to be an increased incidence. Suicide at times. And of course, probably the worst outcome that could be is repeating abortions, a woman punishing herself out of guilt and denying herself any children. Is this also typical?
Well, there's a lot of discussion going on right now about why repeat abortions take place. And I believe, just from dealing with women, and I'm not looking at it from a scientific point of view, but more of an anecdotal point of view, is that women are really trying to come up with a different outcome when they find themselves pregnant a month later after their abortion. It's subtly and unconsciously that they wanted that child, and they're trying to replace that child, and they're trying to come up with a new result. But it becomes kind of a cycle of destruction. And it's very upsetting to me that a girl can go into an abortion clinic and have 5, 6, 7 abortions in a 2, 3 year period of time, and nobody in that clinic will stop and say, what's going on in your life that this cycle has gone on so long? Like, what can we be doing to really help you? Because it's not physically good for you to go through all, you know, to expose yourself to all these procedures. Plus, what's leading you down this road? And how can, I mean, if you're really pro-woman, you don't really want to see a woman do this over and over again and think that she's just using it as, a cheap birth control. It's not cheap physically, emotionally, financially. It takes a great cost, but we don't really stop and ask what's going on in those multiple abortions. There's a lot of sexual abuse. As we deal with women, we find out that there's a history of sexual abuse, so there's real low self-esteem issues that we're dealing with at the heart of these things. I'm finding that there's a lot of that. That there's a lot of issues that are kind of the dysfunctions in a family that are underlying almost to make somebody predisposed to choose abortion. You know, they're more apt to because they don't have the supportive family units. Their family units are dysfunctional.
They in other words, they're more apt to choose it because they have learned throughout the life with their family that they're not going to be there.
Well, they're not going to be there, or that it's the way you handle things. I mean, if your mother says to you, I wish I would have aborted you, and you're a young girl, and you find out you're pregnant 2 years later, what's your mentality going to be?
Or if you know that your mother did abort a sibling.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Well, and it's all of those things. If you don't have a father figure in the family, or if you don't have consistent love in the family, you're out there having sex looking for love. By accident, you get pregnant, then you have to fix your problem. So, it's all discombobulated, and we've tended to think that we can just say, you know, it's a baby, don't have an abortion. And yes, to a great degree, we've saved a great number of babies by doing that. But I think we have to think bigger and think further outside the box to really some of the subtleties that we have injected into our society where abortion is now seen and used dysfunctionally beyond anything, even the pro-aborts first imagined, or Dr. Nathanson and Larry Leader ever imagined when they first said we should do abortions.
Georgette, how do pro-choice groups react to you and to Silent No More?
It's interesting you should ask that, because within the last year we've now learned that they've developed a couple of new websites that one is called I'm Not Sorry. I'm sorry, I don't mean to laugh. One is called I'm Not Sorry. I think it's .com or .net. And the other one is Exhale. And there was a recent article, a big article that ran in one of the Hartford, Connecticut papers. And it's like they're trying to portray that women love abortion. But ironically, the numbers, you know, I mean, they don't get the number of women coming out and saying, hey, let's do a campaign to say I loved killing my baby. In the last year, our list of women who have contacted us has tripled, because women are understanding and hearing this and relating to it. I had a woman, and the thing that really is hard is that the people who are pro-abortion often will say, you're making women feel guilty. You are driving them to feel guilty to kind of create your own audience. And I found that I always find that fascinating, because we don't go out there and, you know, bang on doors and say, did you have an abortion? Let me make you feel guilty. These people contact us. And ironically, when Jennifer O'Neill, who is our celebrity spokesperson for the Silent No More Awareness campaign, was on Bill O'Reilly right before the March for Life and the event that we held in Washington, D.C., we got an email from a woman in Israel. And she simply said, I was sitting at my computer, decided to shut it off for a little while, turned on Bill O'Reilly, and there was Jennifer O'Neill speaking about her regret from her abortion. And she said, her words were things that I have carried in my heart, but I've never said, but I've felt them every day. So I say to those who say, you know, who try to come back at us with, you know, the fact that we try to make these women feel guilty, believe me, that's the last thing that we're after. We don't want to make people feel guilty, but the reality is they carry the guilt. It's inside of us as, I believe, human beings. As humans, God made us to know killing is wrong. And when we take the life of our child, we carry that. And so the women who are out there, the men, the parents of girls who take them to clinics, are now coming forward and saying, I am so sorry for what I did. Help me. Help me find peace and healing and wholeness.
I was going to ask about that, the men's reaction, because there's always a man involved,
yeah,
to one degree or another.
Yeah. And, you know, but on both sides of it, you know, the thing that amazes me is that from the men have the greatest opportunity to influence the woman. In terms of if the man rejects the child, the woman will 90% of the time choose abortion. If the man supports the child's birth, 90% of the time the woman will go through with it. On the other hand, afterwards, you know, what in my situation, in many situations, I think men just don't know what to say. So they've gotten caught in the, well, it's a woman's right, so I can't make a comment, or I have to come across as being very non-caring. It doesn't make any difference to me. It's your choice kind of philosophy. But then these men, you know, get a little older, and they realize they've lost their opportunity for fatherhood. And it calls into question their absolute manhood, because I think at the heart of a man is the desire to protect their young ones, their children. Women's desire is to nurture, man's desire is to protect. And so when you have a man who hasn't protected his young, you have a man who's condemning himself for that and needing the healing and the forgiveness just like women do. And it's available. It's great to know there's some great programs out there for men, too.
Georgette Forney is our guest, co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. We're talking about the after effects of abortion. If you want to join us, we have about 10 minutes left, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. And, of course, as always, when we deal with the delicate subject nature like this, you are invited to call in anonymously, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Georgette, I was disturbed to hear you had mentioned the reaction of pro-choice groups to Silent No More. I was disturbed to hear from a recent guest as we were talking about this that some abortion clinics are kind of undertaking a practice to, I think what they're trying to do is head groups like yours off at the pass.
Mm-hmm.
Before the abortion, they'll have the woman write a letter to her baby saying goodbye. They will encourage the women to go ahead and mourn for the baby. They mm-hmm. will even refer to, in an amazing shift, that this is a baby.
Mm-hmm. They'll even go as far as offering to have the baby baptized in some cases. You know, I mean, what they're doing is they're recognizing the reality of what they're perpetrating. The irony is that if they're pro-choice, if they're really focused on choice, and they see that a woman is struggling so that they're offering her these helps, doesn't it logically, you know, kind of follow that they should offer them some other choices? And that's where you have to recognize that what they're doing is they're trying to cover themselves and not really, again, showing real concern for the woman and her choice. It really isn't about her choice, as they like to package it as, you know, we have to protect a woman's right, you know, her privacy between her and her doctor to make this choice. Well, there's no doctor involved in the situation when a young girl is sitting in a clinic and a counselor who's had 2 hours worth of training sits next to the girl and says, here, fill out this little heart piece of paper and write a note to your baby. That will feel better. There is nothing choice-driven about that. And that's what, but you know what? In reality, I think that there's nothing we can do about what they're doing in that situation except be grateful that they're realizing that there is something that needs to be done, and maybe that will, in and of itself, that they're doing that, it might save a baby. Who knows?
Let's go to the phones, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Kathy is calling from St. Charles. Kathy, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Pastor. My sister had had an abortion and had told us, myself and some of our family members, after she had had it. But also since then, she suffers with depression. And it's just a very isolating experience. She doesn't ever want to talk about it very much, but she's very against abortion. But also just not having a close relationship with her affects me as a sister. My mother's passed away from breast cancer. And so, you know, the rippling effects of abortion just go on and on. Mm-hmm. I don't get to see my nieces and nephews very much because of the struggle she has with the depression. And it's just, if she had had support from our family, I don't think she would have had it. But, you know, there was not support. My father had let us know, as girls, if anything ever happened to us, that we should feel free to kill ourselves, because he knew that, you know, it would be better to do that than to have an unwanted baby. So, you know, I think and this was in a Christian home. We were taken to church every week. So I think, you know, there are long-lasting effects that abortion has that people don't even think about.
Thank you, Kathy. Georgette, your response?
Well, it amazes me over and over again, because there's a whole family that is grieving the loss of that child that one sister aborted, and it does devastate. And therefore, folks, as you're listening and you think abortion doesn't affect you, it does affect us all, because women who have had abortions don't live in capsules. We live our lives, and they seep out all over the place. And so there's that young family. Those children of that young mother are being denied family members. So therefore, there's a lack of connection. Where does that go down the road? It's amazing how over and over again we have to deal with the other family members who are hurting. This young woman, Kathy, who's called in, is saying that she's mourning the loss of her relationship with her sister. And it goes on and on and on, and it's so unnecessary. Because the reality is, we can have our children, and we can provide the resources and assistance that women need so they don't have to choose abortion.
There's one other issue that Kathy raised that I had recently come across, and that is statistically of Christian young women who have abortions, and they tend to have abortions at a very similar rate to the general population.
Well, and for the very reason that Kathy's father told them to.
Yes, the primary influence was found to be that of their Christian church-going mothers. Their mothers convinced them to have the abortion.
Well, and here's the simple take on that. You have a situation in which, you know, we tell our kids not to have sex. And then in the Christian family, they come home and they're pregnant. Well, you know, you're not going to embarrass the family. And that is such a narrow approach, but a very typical approach. You know, our family name is greater than our grandchild. And that so undermines it. But you don't know if previously in that family's life there was an abortion. I mean, abortion tends to be generational, so you have that to deal with. And I think the other side of it, and this is something that the other co-founding group that supports the Silent No More Awareness Campaign is Priests for Life, and Janet Moran is my co-founder from Priests for Life. And Father Frank always talks about the fact that, you know, we need to separate sexual activity from the pregnancy. So if a young couple, a young, you know, man or his girlfriend or the girl comes home and she's pregnant, we need to separate that, the sin of their sexual activity, because now we're dealing with a pregnancy.
Amen.
And there's a child involved, and we need to, as parents, know that that's the message we give our kids, and that our kids can know hey, look, if I come home, if I find out I'm pregnant, I can come home and I can find help.
What about in the very brief few minutes that we have, no more than two here, on the legislation front involving allowing parents to be involved through, say, parental consent laws or parental notification laws or informed consent for the woman or the girl herself? What are your thoughts?
I think those are all really necessary, and I really wish they would have been in place when I was a kid. And I think that that will help eliminate some of the abortions. And there is no silver bullet that's going to eliminate all abortion. It's going to take all of our efforts on a myriad of fronts to make abortion unthinkable and no more necessary. But I do think that we need to look at other legislation like studying the after effects of abortion. Do you know that this is the only medical procedure that is done? It's the most frequently done medical procedure on women that has never been studied after 30 years? Now, I mean, you know, stop and think about that. There is no way any other medical procedure would get away with that kind of lack of study. I mean, they were studying, they study crazy things, and they report those things. But there's no way nobody wants to touch this. If we really care about women, we should demand it. So while there's legislation to you know, for parental consent and informed consent, which are really important, I think we need to look at demanding some sort of legislation that calls for the CDC to get statistics from every state. States are not required to report their numbers. Clinics are not required to be, controlled by state laws. I mean, the whole abortion industry and the whole issue has been so unregulated that there are a lot more things that we need to be doing.
Georgette Forney, thank you for your good work. Keep it up, please, and thanks for being our guest.
Okay, blessings to you.
Georgette Forney is co-founder of the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. Their website, it's long, but it's easy to remember. SilentAwarenessNoMore.org. SilentAwarenessNoMore, all one word, please, .org. They also have a toll-free number, 1-800-707-NOEL. 1-800-707-NOEL, the number for the Silent No More Awareness Campaign. The more I talk about this, folks, the more I am convinced that Georgette is right. This is a multi-front battle. Legislative, for the hearts and minds of people, talking about the effects on women, continuing to remind everyone who it is we're dealing with in the womb, our fellow human beings, our neighbors. When we come back, we'll be talking with Uwe Simonetto. Get a religion roundup in the second hour of Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.